A cruise company could face heavy penalties, and a group of wealthy Americans take issue with the current tax system. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Carnival Corporation could face a heavy penalty. They may lose the ability to dock their ships in U.S. ports temporarily if a judge decides to go that far. Why? Well, allegedly, the company has violated its probation and has continued dumping things like oil and waste into the ocean. So what's going to happen to the company next, especially in times like these when the cruise industry is growing? Also, we'll meet a researcher at Florida Atlantic University who is worried that people living in the rural regions of the country don't know enough about Alzheimer's. She has a program that could change that, and she'll share some of that with us. And finally, this is Tax Day, and we're going to introduce you to the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of wealthy individuals who want to change the tax system. They believe the rich are not taxed enough. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the cruise industry is booming. Passenger growth was up 7% last year, almost 28.5 million riders. Now, that growth is expected to continue and generate an economic impact of $134 billion coming up. But one local company is facing some scrutiny. Last week, a federal judge threatened Carnival Cruises by saying that they may lose the ability to dock in U.S. ports temporarily. It stems from the company violating its probation for illegally dumping oil in the ocean. Taylor Dolvin covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. She joins us now from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Taylor, a pleasure.
Hi, Luis. Thanks for having me.
All right. So describe for us briefly what that probation that Carnival is facing. What does that probation entail?
Yeah. So Carnival Corporation, which owns Carnival Cruise Lines and eight other cruise companies, has been on probation since 2017 when it violated federal environmental laws. It was convicted of those crimes. The probation is supposed to last 5 years. And as part of it, a court-appointed monitor visits ships for inspections, interviews executives and employees, and also has access to all internal investigations and records.
So the company settled for $40 million for illegally dumping oil, of all things, into the ocean from its Princess Cruises. How many times or for how long were these ships illegally dumping things?
Right. So in 2013, a newly hired engineer from the UK on the Caribbean Princess cruise ship noticed that pollution prevention equipment was rigged so that the ship was able to dump oily waste overboard without any alarm sounding. I believe this is engine oil waste product that drains to the very bottom of the ship and is supposed to be separated out, not dumped overboard. So the British engineer reported that information to authorities, and the U.S. Coast Guard opened an investigation. The company tried to cover up the crimes when they found out they were under investigation, but investigators eventually found that Princess Cruise Line ships, five of them, had been dumping oily waste illegally and covering it up over a span of 8 years. The exact locations of the dumps are hard to pinpoint because the records were falsified as part of the scheme, but we do know that one instance off the coast of England happened when the engineer reported. And the judge made Carnival pay that engineer $1 million of the $40 million settlement in 2017. And it's important to note that Carnival Corporation was convicted of the exact same crime back in 2002 and put on probation for 5 years. And Royal Caribbean Cruises and Norwegian Cruise Line have also committed the same crime in the last few decades.
And the company, by the way, also tried to lobby the Coast Guard to change the terms of the settlement. Help me understand that.
Yeah. So during the probation window, the court-appointed monitor is supposed to record things that go wrong, including broken equipment on Carnival's ships. Carnival didn't agree with that parameter. They didn't want broken equipment to be included. So a senior VP for Environment Management, who was a retired Coast Guard admiral at Carnival, sent an email to his former colleagues at the Coast Guard asking them what they thought. The government says Carnival was trying to lobby the Coast Guard to get on their side, and Carnival says it was just getting clarification.
What else have these ships been dumping?
Yeah, so the court-appointed monitor has found that Carnival has continued to violate environmental laws while on probation, including dumping plastic and gray water into protected areas. They've also dumped sewage and small amounts of oil.
All right, U.S. District Judge Patricia Seitz, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, last week scolded the company's chairman, Mickey Arison, and the president, Arnold Donald. What did she say exactly?
She was really stern and seemed very frustrated. She called the company a recidivist criminal and said she wished that she could give Arison and Donald a visit to the detention center. She'll decide whether these violations merit a probation violation at a hearing in June, and she floated the idea of temporarily banning Carnival Corporation's 102 ships from docking at U.S. ports as sort of a sanction for this behavior.
And you had also pointed out that Carnival, and I think you mentioned just a second ago, too, that they had a program in place to get ready for these court order audits. My understanding is the company knew when the audit was coming, so they would try to get ready for it and fix any issues and make it look like everything was running perfectly.
Right. So for the first 8 months of probation, Carnival Corporation would send people to its ships right before the court-appointed monitor would arrive to make sure that there wouldn't be any negative findings. The monitor expresses frustration about this in court filings, saying, you know, I would show up, everything would look fine, and they wouldn't tell me what they had just fixed. Carnival says it stopped doing that in December 2017, but prosecutors say it continued into 2018.
I'm talking with Taylor Dolvin with the Miami Herald. Last week, a federal judge threatened to prevent Carnival Corporation, Carnival Cruises, from docking their ships in U.S. ports temporarily, this for violating their probation. Taylor's joining us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. So, Taylor, what did the company say? I mean, you have a judge who was, as you said, being very stern with the leaders of this company and making this threat that possibly you won't be able to dock any of your ships in U.S. ports for a while. But has the company responded?
Yeah, it's important to note the executives weren't at last week's hearing, but Judge Seitz requested that they be at the next hearing in June when she'll make the call on if this behavior merits a probation violation. But at first, the company said there were mischaracterizations made at the hearing and that environmental protection is a top priority for the company. They kind of walked that back a few days later and said they heard the judge's concerns and would ensure that they meet all of the expectations.
So recently, the cruise industry had a big event in South Florida, the Sea Trade event in Miami Beach, and announced that last year was, again, as I pointed out, 7% growth in passengers, and they expect more growth in 2019. What reasons do they give for that increase in business? What do they say is happening?
So they said cruising is becoming a more mainstream vacation option. And they've had some success attracting millennials in recent years, which is a new kind of market for them. The industry is also diversifying by building both bigger ships and smaller ships to attract a more wide range of people.
So it's not just that ships are getting bigger, but they're not just going bigger. Not all ships are getting bigger, right?
Yeah, yes and no. Yes, because in coming years, there are going to be ships coming out that will hold more passengers than ever before. We're talking 7,000 passengers. But also no, because we'll have brands like the soon-to-launch Ritz-Carlton cruise/yacht ship that will hold just 300 passengers coming out. It's a variety, I think.
And what did they say are the biggest challenges for the industry? I mean, that things are looking good, business is good, but there've got to be some challenges. Everything can't be perfect.
So at Sea Trade, interestingly, they talked a lot about pushing back against misperceptions of cruising. Unfortunately, what they characterize as a misperception of environmental mismanagement has proved to be a continued problem for the industry, even when companies like Carnival are under a microscope.
And again, as you mentioned, that hearing for Carnival, that's coming up in June.
Yep.
Something to keep a hold, just keep an eye on. We're going to see what happens with that. Taylor Dolvin, again, with the Miami Herald, talking to us a little bit about the cruise industry. Big part of our industry here in South Florida. What could happen to Carnival Cruises? Again, we'll keep an eye on that story. Taylor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Luis.
And again, she joined us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Well, still to come, we're going to look at a new FAU tool that helps reach people who may not have access to information about Alzheimer's. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Nearly 6 million Americans live with the disease, and by 2050, it's projected to rise to 14 million. This according to recent numbers from the Alzheimer's Association. Researchers and professors at Florida Atlantic University have found many older adults tend to live in more rural settings, and that could lead to a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's. People in these areas often lack access to proper health care and educational services. Dr. Lisa Wiese recently received a grant from the Association of Community Health Nursing Educators and Florida Department of Health to survey Floridians in these rural communities and to know the knowledge that they have and how perhaps getting more information to them about Alzheimer's. She's an assistant professor at Florida Atlantic University's C.E. Lynn College, and she joins us now from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Dr. Wiese, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What do you find most frustrating about the current science and understanding about Alzheimer's right now?
Most frustrating are the myths that people still carry about Alzheimer's disease and thinking that nothing can be done. Researchers now know that up to 30% of Alzheimer's disease cases could be slowed or even prevented with behavior modification for things like adequate nutrition, sleep, stress levels, managing comorbidities. Those are all lifestyle changes that can be made to help decrease the risk. And so my frustration is that people still think that if you say the word Alzheimer's disease or dementia, it's a death sentence, but it is not.
What is right now the challenge, as you see it, in reaching patients and just people in general, in some of the rural parts of the country, especially here in Florida?
That's a very good question. In rural areas, we know that we have less providers. The transportation to get to providers, especially specialty providers who are trained in specific topics that are relative to older adults, is very difficult. So we often see this disconnect between people who are at higher risk for Alzheimer's disease in rural populations because those areas tend to have older adults and age-related Alzheimer's disease is more significant there, and getting them to these providers. And we have an answer for that. We have gerontology-trained nurse practitioners who are willing to go out to rural areas and offer in-depth screenings and make recommendations to the participants' providers or even take on the care of that person themselves.
What is your connection to this disease? What's your interest in understanding and helping people with this disease?
My own mother passed from Alzheimer's disease at almost age 98, but I'm from West Virginia, Appalachian area, but she was very fortunate in that her primary provider recognized her symptoms immediately and put her on medications. We do know that an earlier start to medication therapy and lifestyle changes can make a big difference in how effective those are. So she actually never progressed in her illness much beyond the extreme short-term memory loss that people experience and had a very productive and fulfilling life until shortly before she died. And that motivated me to try to help other people in rural areas who don't often have access to be able to follow that same path for managing disease.
I am sorry for your loss in that case, and I do know how that is, having lost a grandmother to this disease. The tool that you created, the tool that you're working on, I should say, again, to help, one, to find out what people know, but also to help them get that information. How does it work?
So this tool is available for anyone who wants to use it, and it's also been translated into Creole and Spanish. We have good psychometrics on that, meaning it's been piloted and tested well. And you could take that into your community setting, senior living, churches, wherever you have a gathering of adults. And it doesn't even need to be older adults. It can be younger adults who need to be made aware of the long-term impact of lifestyle. But and find out what they know and don't know. And then we do education and correct those myths. For example, a lot of people think that persons with Alzheimer's disease or dementia don't have pain the same way, or maybe they're not depressed. And so we can educate persons and caregivers that that is not the case.
Before the work that you've been doing, was anybody looking into, you know, that portion of the population that is living outside of the big cities, that's living away from everybody else?
There was a lot of attention to rural disease in terms of diabetes and prostate cancer, but not Alzheimer's disease. And I was mentored by my professors at FAU who said, you know, we have these measures about knowledge of Alzheimer's disease that target professionals, but no one targeting persons in rural or underserved populations.
Let's talk about where you're looking. What are some of the communities you're looking at?
So what I did first is I started in the rural areas of Florida and Belle Glade and Bohokie and around the Glades region. And then once we had a defined version of the knowledge measure, then we went to five different counties in five different states in rural areas, such as Alabama, North Carolina, Virginia, and so on.
From the data that you collected, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying at the beginning, is maybe what some of these myths are. People don't have all the knowledge about what this disease is. But what did you learn about what folks in those communities like Bohokie and Belle Glade know or don't know about Alzheimer's?
It was very surprising because most of those people understood what many people in urban areas do not, and that is that if you have heart disease, such as high blood pressure or have had a stroke, or you're diabetic, you have a 1.5 to 2 times higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. That was really eye-opening to me, is these people were so in touch in those illnesses because they deal with them all the time, and they were able to make the connection that, yes, there's something between, you know, my circulation and my increased risk for Alzheimer's disease.
You know, thinking too also to not just what they know, but how about access? What kind of access do they have to medical professionals who can help them with this specific disease?
Another surprising thing I found was that most of these rural residents do have a primary provider that they have a strong relationship with and that they, you know, feel confident in going to and see regularly. What is not happening is they're not being tested for memory loss. There's no cognitive screening going on. Even though if you ask the provider, which we did, we asked 12 providers out there, or the participants, hundreds of them, if they would want to be screened, and overwhelmingly, 88% wanted to be screened, but it's not happening because either the provider is too busy or they think they can't manage the illness if they do detect it. And what's interesting is that the National Institute of Aging realized this as a problem, and they designed a whole series of training modules and algorithms designed just for rural providers. But no one knows about it, and they're not accessing it.
Usually at what age should people start getting, I guess, memory tested? But, you know, when should they start, I guess, going to the doctor and checking on that possibility?
That is a great question. Right now, Medicare and Medicaid will cover memory screening starting at age 65 and up. And they actually state that has to be part of the annual memory or annual wellness visit, is to do memory screening. And one thing that we know, because it is age-related, the older you get, the more likely you are to have Alzheimer's disease or develop it. And in persons over 85, the Alzheimer's Association has found out that 50% of persons have Alzheimer's disease. Now, that said, we have a huge number of people who are developing Alzheimer's disease, what we call early onset, at a younger age. And I'm hoping in my research, eventually, as I mentioned earlier, to be able to start targeting people in their mid-40s and looking at who is at risk for that.
Yeah. Well, all right. Wait, hold on a second. You say mid-40s. Let's back up a second, and let me ask you about this. When you say early onset, usually what are you seeing?
So what we're seeing is it's usually genetic related or injury related. I'm sure you're aware of the NFL findings that are coming out with head injury and things like that. So that's why I want to, be looking more at those populations as well as older adults, but also educating them about those very important behavior modifications. And one of my mentors at FAU, Dr. Jim Galvin, who's really world-renowned for work in this area, he is studying gait training and physical changes and vision changes in people to help them detect it earlier so that we can get those medications on earlier, help them to make the lifestyle changes.
So you think that also that testing should even start in people in their 40s?
Only if they have symptoms of memory loss. I don't want to get everyone concerned and scared, but, people who are having symptoms of short-term memory loss definitely need to be evaluated, where you're repeating the same things over and over again, or as we're seeing with head injury, where you have sudden changes in emotion and mood, or you suddenly are starting to have vision changes. There's all kinds of things that can cause those things to happen, but we need to rule those out. And if we can rule them out, then we can look further at are there plaques and tangles? Because right now we have PET scans that can determine plaques and tangles that are created by the tau protein responsible for Alzheimer's disease. We all have a little bit of that. The question is how much. And sometimes these other things going on earlier in life predispose people to that. And I believe that the Alzheimer's Association and the new report that came out last month on the Alzheimer's Facts and Figures report stated that we have over 200,000 people with early onset Alzheimer's disease.
And we do have that report on our social media, again, at WLRN Sundial. And when you were mentioning athletes, just to point out that that's the CTE issue with especially football players.
That's right.
I'm talking with Dr. Lisa Wiese. She is an assistant professor at Florida Atlantic University's C.E. Lynn College of Nursing. And she received a grant recently from the Association of Community Health Nursing Educators and the Florida Department of Health to test and conduct research based on her survey that tests the basic knowledge of Alzheimer's disease, especially in rural communities. As she said, she's looking in communities in the Belglade, Pahokee, Clewiston region. Again, this tool is now being tested on older adults in rural parts of Florida. Tell us a little bit about some of these groups that you've worked with in your research, again, from those areas, from that rural part of Florida. What are the stories they're sharing with you? What have you learned so far?
Oh, thank you for asking that. One thing that I've really learned in rural areas is that community is as they say, everything. So they have a real compassion for helping each other, and they want education, and they want to be included in research and what's going on. So this is a whole area that we could tap into. And faith is often very important, to people in rural areas. That's a lot of times where the center of activity is in a community. And so reaching those faith-based settings in rural areas has been very rewarding for us in pilot testing. And we received a word of good scoring for a grant with the National Institute of Aging to adapt a Faith Moves Mountains models in rural areas to try to increase the knowledge and awareness and screening for Alzheimer's disease.
And how would that work exactly? What's the approach that would be different in reaching a faith-based community?
Oh, so what you do is you work with the people in the community, something called community-based participatory research, where you go to the leaders and work with them, and they're the experts in the community for working out how we best reach the people in that region. And faith-based means that you're tying in that particular faith's dogma and spiritual practices, such as, Bible verses or readings from the Torah or the Quran and singing in some cases, and tying that into, weekly steps where you're going to learn to manage dementia, illness or behaviors that are leading to a dementia-like illness.
Interesting, you know, talking about this idea of science and faith. And we had a conversation recently with a gentleman who's a priest, but also a biology teacher at St. Thomas University. And they were talking about how to discuss climate science with people, you know, people of faith, and how those two sometimes don't mix. But how do you get people talking about it? Do you find there's a challenge when you're trying to talk to people of any faith, doesn't matter, any particular faith, when you're talking about science, you're talking about medicine, you're talking about how those things help us understand a disease like Alzheimer's?
There is a concern, because a lot of times people with a strong faith, and I'm one of those people, tend to believe that if God wills, so be it. You know, we call that fatalism. But you know, you have to work with them through their faith beliefs to help them understand that whatever power you believe in, that they want you to also do self-care and self-help. And so that has been a real challenge, especially in communities where they're used to taking care of their own, such as in Appalachia. You know, that's been a real issue. Oh, well, you know, my mother had it, my dad had it, my aunt had it. You know, we all know how to take care of this, and we'll take care of each other. And, you know, if God means for me to have it, then I'm going to have it. So, you know, getting them educated to understand that it, again, is not a death sentence is a big part of changing the culture of how we look at Alzheimer's disease, just like we did with cancer. You know, cancer used to be a very taboo word, and it still is a serious word, but now people realize a lot of times there's real treatment for it.
You know, we come back to this idea of education, and wondering, I mean, is it as easy as let's just make sure we got all that information online and people can just find it? Or do you have to go to them? How do we get that education to them? And I'm wondering why you're laughing.
Yeah, because that's the big thing with rural populations is, you know, is reaching them. We can't expect them to come to us. We have to go to them. And that's why the faith-based settings are so wonderful, because if you can get something started there and they can reach out and it's a community-based participatory type of program, then it will continue to propagate.
How long is this study going to go?
3 years.
And what's the next step in this research? And it's part of it's collecting data. Part of it is education, reaching out, as you said, finding a way to reach these communities.
The next step is getting providers to the rural areas. Nurse practitioners are perfectly positioned to do that. They have a real compassion for people, especially gerontology nurse practitioners who are trained in those illnesses. So it would be great if there was a policy change to allow for nurse practitioners to bill for service out in rural area for specialty consultations, just like we do for specialty providers in more urban areas, because right now the way it's set is the provider that's seeing the patient can bill for that, but the nurse practitioner can't come along and bill for that as well. So, you know, the policy changes, rewarding practitioners for being out in the rural areas to service those areas, and also empowering people to reach clinics through transportation, through share rides, through, you know, free Uber or whatever it would be, you know, to get people to those clinics. Those are all things that we're looking at to try to increase knowledge and access.
So it sounds like it has to be more face-to-face than, say, digital, it had, you know, in order to really have impact.
That's a very good point, especially for our older adults. And a lot of people in the Glades area, they're retired farm workers, migrant workers. You know, they don't own a computer or a laptop. So that face-to-face is vital. That is the key. You're absolutely right. For younger generations who are living in rural areas, people in their 50s and 60s, they're more confident or have more access to computers, and they're not as what we call computer illiterate as our older adults.
You know, coming back to you personally, because, you know, it's interesting. I mean, one, you're a researcher, you're a scientist. But as you said, you know, you have faith. You have a faith in your life, and you've been through this personal experience. For you, what's changed over the years in your understanding and the way you think about this disease?
That is a beautiful question. Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. You know, I've had time to reflect on that because it was my brother who had the primary care responsibilities for my mother because he lived in West Virginia. I was here in Florida. And I realized that a lot of the concern I have is for the caregiver. And, you know, that it has been recognized as a huge issue in people with Alzheimer's disease is the caregivers often end up with as much stress and more illnesses and actually earlier death than many of the people they're caring for. So I have reflected on that. It's really important to treat both the participant and the caregiver together.
It definitely does. I can attest to that. I know exactly what you mean. Dr. Lisa Wiese, again, Assistant Professor at Florida Atlantic University's C.E. Lynn College of Nursing, again, conducting research on what people know about Alzheimer's and in getting education, especially out there to the communities in the rural parts of Florida and around the country. Dr. Wiese, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
And you can learn more about this research on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to meet a group of millionaires and billionaires who don't like the current tax system. They want to be taxed more. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, you know what today is, right? Well, it's the day after the Masters tournament. I hope you watched it. It was a lot of fun. No, today is tax day, and millions of Americans are still filing their taxes. And there's one group of Americans that takes serious issue with the tax system as it stands. They feel that they're being taxed too little. They're called the Patriotic Millionaires, and they've been advocating for greater taxes on millionaires since 2010 in response to President Bush's tax cuts. In order to become a member, you must have an income over $1 million and or assets of over $5 million. Robert Goldschmidt joined the Patriotic Millionaires back in 2016. He's a retired IT professional living in Miami. Mr. Goldschmidt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I'm in Sarasota, Florida
today. Oh, okay. Well, you know what? Still in the Sunshine State, still in sunny Florida.
Yes. Yes.
Let me start with this. What are your current thoughts on the tax system as we have it right now?
The tax system is totally had it. It's totally distorted. And we've had some things going on in our economy for decades that have caused this to happen. Most recently, the $1.5 trillion tax cut over 10 years that was passed by the Trump administration is an indication of how sick things have become, because it gives only 1% of the proceeds to the bottom two-thirds of us. And now we're faced with a proposed budget that would pay for that cut through destruction of many programs benefiting families. It literally proposes taking milk out of the mouths of babies. So you can see the whole system has become totally distorted. And just as the justice system is much worse for people on the bottom, the tax system is much worse for people on the bottom.
So let me make sure that I'm clear on this. I don't want to generalize, but is this group basically saying, hey, us, those 1%, you know, in earnings, we're not being taxed enough?
Oh, of course not. Of course not. We have all kinds of loopholes that we can use. And now the latest one is in this $1.5 trillion tax cut. Typically, wealthy individual will have what's called a pass-through corporation, where they have a corporation for which they get the proceeds. And we just got a 20% cut in our taxes on any of the income from such a corporation. That was in the bill. And so any of the people who don't have a pass-through corporation, which are most of the people struggling out there, do not benefit from this, and they may end up having to pay for it if we're not going to go into deeper debt. So this is totally distorted and unfair. And in the patriotic millionaires, we are known for the tax part of this, but we're involved in health, we're involved in environment and in economics. And I guess I would be one of the most analytical members of the group who constantly tries to understand the underlying forces that are controlling our destinies. And how did we get in this position?
Yeah.
And what it is that's getting, what has caused this?
Well, let's look at it this way. And again, not to get too deep into the weeds here when we talk about taxes, but what does a fair tax system look like for the patriotic millionaires?
Well, for starters, just to clean it up a little bit, I would say that everyone should pay the same percentage as a minimum of their gross income. You know, the problem of an executive paying a lower percentage than their secretary is absolutely ridiculous. So for starters, you'd have to get to at least at that point. We're not even at that point yet. We actually pay less in a percentage of our income than a worker does.
But how about this? Because the other thing too, for most of us, we just have that one income, or maybe we have a couple of jobs, but it is a salary, or it is we're working per hour. But again, I'm generalizing. I wouldn't know, but just from stuff I've read, that when it comes to millionaires and billionaires, I mean, it's not so much an income. It's not a salary. It is, you know, it's stock options. It's all these other streams of revenue that you have that are siphoned through corporations even. I mean, so.
Yes. All of that is true. I'd want to say, first of all, that I'm not a billionaire, far from that.
Okay. All right.
And I have been on an unemployment line at previous times of my life. I've done manual labor, so I've seen all sides of this.
Okay. So when it comes to part of it, as you said, to even get started is to say, look, whatever your income is, everybody should be taxed the same percentage, the same rate, so you don't have any unevenness there. But what about all those loopholes? What about how do you tax a millionaire or billionaire, again, considering all the different ways they're making money?
Well, the real problem, if you really want to go down to the basic problem we have, is that not enough money is going to workers in the form of salaries. That is the underlying problem we have. And the reason for that is that we've allowed monopolies in this country to form, and they're basically price gouging everyone. And that problem is 10 times bigger than this latest tax cut. I mean, we're talking about a purchasing power loss on the order of $20,000 a year for a working family. And that's because we've allowed monopolies to reform. And this is really the critical thing that's affecting our society and causing a growing percentage of our citizens to live without dignity, which is very, very dangerous for our democracy.
So let me come back to this also, just because I want to clarify this as well. We continue this idea of how do we change the tax system? And part of the other thing too, is where we can put our money. And a lot of Americans don't have access to some of these places where they can just move their money to protect it. I mean, is it also about getting rid of loopholes and getting rid of some of
those? Oh, yes, of course. Well, that's why I said gross income.
Let
everyone be taxed on their gross income. That's before any deductions, any loopholes, anything, by the same amount. That would be the first big step forward if you're going to upgrade the tax system. So you will pay this much. Now, we had something like that, which was the minimum tax, but it got totally chewed up. And those of us that are over 65 remember a time around 1970 when a family with a single worker could live in dignity, could pay for a home, put food on the table, afford health insurance, and send their children to state college. And it turns out this was true for almost a quarter of a century, from 1948 to 1972. And we know that this works. During this period, we had a win-win economy where both workers and owners of businesses thrived. And you know what happened, how we killed the goose that laid the golden eggs? Very simply, the federal government stopped enforcing competition, which is the fundamental elements of capitalism. We like to think that we live in a capitalistic society, but 75 to 90% of all purchases are now made from a few large corporations, which means we are no longer in a capitalistic system because competition does no longer exist.
Let me, only because of time, I wanted to come back to you for a second. I mentioned at the beginning, you got involved with this group back in 2016. How and why?
Yeah, I realized that they were a group that could give me some leverage for the analysis that I've been working on. I'm a very analytical person, as I said, and to try to get this out to the outside world so that people can understand what's happening. I mean, you know, here, for example, in Sarasota County, 30% of our families skip one or more meals a month to make ends meet. So we're in a situation where as you have larger and larger portion of our society living without dignity, where people become irrational and they will vote for anyone who promises them that they're going to upend this system and somehow improve their lives. So if we don't fix this, we're going to see the demise of our country across the board. You're going to see democracy, human rights, dignity, the whole thing go down the tubes.
You recently traveled to Washington, D.C. You met with lawmakers like Nancy Pelosi. This was last November. What was the focus of that visit? What did you hear from lawmakers?
Well, lawmakers, unfortunately, live by the rule that they have to get reelected. And that's the system. What's happened is not only of the monopoly, you see the extra money that monopolies make from price gouging not only is worse than a tax, because when you pay a tax to the government spends that tax on goods and services, which then creates jobs. When a monopoly takes extra profits and puts it in their own pockets, they use that to take out other businesses and to increase the price of the stocks, or the value of stocks. So they use these excess profits to buy Congress, to buy the regulators. And that's what's happened. They've entrenched their position so that we don't really have representative government, I'm afraid to say right now. We have 80% of the people that want background checks for guns, but the government doesn't go along with
let me ask you this. Is it a particular party, or do you think the whole system, all politicians?
No, this is a systemic thing that's been going on for 45 years through both parties. Both parties have gone along with this rise of the monopolies. We basically, the only thing that will save us at this point is if we elect basically a third Roosevelt. That's the only way we're going to get out of this, who's willing to go around and push back on the monopolies in a fearless way and get the system back in order. You know, we've gone through this twice before in our history.
Yeah.
And we've saved ourselves, but now we're up against it again.
I just want to mention I'm talking with Robert Goldschmidt. He's a South Florida-based retiree, a member of a group called Patriotic Millionaires. This is a group of wealthy individuals advocating for changes in the U.S. tax system to more equitably tax the highest-earning Americans. Mr. Goldschmidt, how do other wealthy Americans, millionaires and billionaires, feel about this group? The group's been around almost a decade now.
Well, many, they sort of split up, okay? I would say the ones that are more progressive are highly in favor of it and would, you know, are backing such an effort. Those that are not progressive say that, you know, everyone should fend for themselves, and if they die because they don't have health care, too bad, or, you know, they don't have enough to eat, too bad. But so you get both kinds. The system, when we allow the system to get out of kilter like this, we attract people who tend to be very narcissistic to certain groups in society, because in the economy, because they need people who don't care, who will just worry about profits.
What about,
the implications?
What do you say to folks who will respond by telling you, look, putting more money into the pockets of wealthy Americans leads to greater spending and it spurs economic activity?
Well, we've proved over and over and over again that that is not the case. Just look at the last tax cut. We just tossed $1.5 trillion into the hopper. And what do we have to show for it? Nothing except a big expense bill. We didn't get any more jobs. We didn't get any more strengthening of the economy. So we've proved that over and over again, that the trickle down doesn't work at all. And we proved over and over again that increasing the pay of workers is by far the best way to run an economy, because when workers get an increase, they spend the money and it gets fed back into the economy and it grows. When you give an increase to somebody who's very wealthy, their spending on goods and services in general doesn't change at all. They just increase their investments in the market and so on. So none of that money flows back into the economy in the form of purchases of goods and services.
You know, the issue of taxes will come up during a presidential election, but you know, we still have a lot of time before 2020, and you know, there are a lot of candidates on the Democratic side, a lot of different issues to talk about. How do you want to hear people in this upcoming election talk about taxes? And do you think either side is really going to do anything close to what you're hoping the country needs to do?
Well, again, it depends on the form of Congress, how much you're going to get away with. Certainly, at this point, I would say that if one party gets control of all three, you know, the two branches of government and the presidency at the same time, they will throw away the filibuster and just start passing things, so that we have to be very careful who we give those powers to. But certainly if a progressive president is elected, they would even the playing field very rapidly. I think you would see estate taxes returning. You might see something like a wealth tax that Elizabeth Warren is talking about.
So is there a candidate, a Democratic candidate, who best represents some of these ideals that you're talking about?
Well, in my mind, and again, I'm looking at a third Roosevelt. That's what I think we need. It goes beyond taxes. It means breaking up the monopolies and controlling them and regulating them properly. But and if that's the case, I see that both Elizabeth Warren and Pete, I can't pronounce his name. Buttigieg.
Yeah.
Would seem to be the two principal candidates that are fearless in this regard and have the background to understand where all the skeletons are hidden.
And are the patriotic millionaires putting any money into this campaign, to anybody's campaign?
No, I think we have a policy of not participating in the political system in that way. We tend to be apolitical. We have members from both Republicans and Democrats, but they tend to be more progressive people. But they are, in general, across the board, all people that are worried about these long-term trends. They're not good. They're not good. And like I say, this effect of price gouging of monopolies is a much bigger problem than taxes. It's an order of magnitude bigger. That $20,000 a year is the difference between dignity and no dignity for tens of millions of families. And that is where the rubber meets the road. If we don't address that, I'm afraid we're going to see our democracy and our human rights and our dignity all compromised.
Robert Goldschmidt, again a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of wealthy individuals advocating for changes to the U.S. tax system and more, as you've been hearing him tell us. Mr. Goldschmidt, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hernandez.
And you can learn more about this group on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And that's our program for this Monday, April 15th. Happy Tax Day. Is that a right thing to say? Can I say that? Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, you're going to hear our conversation with T. Kira Madden. She's behind the memoir, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. That's our April title for the Sundial Book Club. You can always join the club, by the way. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club, and ask to join. We'd love to have you. Also, comic book lovers, the new exhibition at the Boca Raton Museum of Art goes beyond the Cape. Really interesting exhibit. We'll tell you all about that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.